Hi everyone, it's Aliza Licht here, your host, and I'm so thrilled to share that my new book, On Brand, Shape Your Narrative, Share Your Vision, Shift Their Perception, is out now. I hope you'll pick up a copy because personal branding is for everyone. It's for the new graduate starting out, the middle manager looking to level up, the executive who wants to be a thought leader, the entrepreneur starting from scratch. It's for anyone who wants to pivot or transition into something new. Because having a strong personal brand means that your name gets dropped in rooms you're not in, and that you're thought of for opportunities that other people haven't even heard of yet. So pick up a copy, and I can't wait to hear what you think. Hi, this is Aliza Licht, and this is Leave Your Mark, the podcast, where I brew fresh career advice with some of my most inspiring and successful friends. It's professional advice that you can action immediately, whether you're just starting out in your career or well on your way. With a massive to-do list and a large cup of coffee, I promise that you can get it all done and still have time to post about it. Hiva Palapu is a consummate multi-hyphenate. I mean, literally, if you look up multi-hyphenate in the dictionary, Hiva space is there. She is an entrepreneur. She's an author. She's a speaker. She's the CEO of Rochon Pharmaceuticals, whose lead product was acquired by Hilaris Pharmaceuticals. So she's a badass science chick also. She is the author of We're Speaking, The Life Lessons of Kamala Harris, and totally separate, How to Pack Travel Smart for Any Trip, because those two things totally go together. I mean, this is what I love about you. You have this amazing newsletter, Five Smart Reads, which is Webby honored, and you curate news from around the world to over 82,000 accounts. You speak, you're an angel investor, you're on multiple boards. I mean, you have a life outside of all of this. You're married, you have two kids, you live in New York. You're doing it all, Hiva. And I want to know, do you have more than 24 hours in your day?
No, but I am incapable of saying no. And I drink a lot of coffee and I don't do all those things at the same time. So it's also important to say, I try to maybe only have two hats on a single time. But yes, it's not like I'm a mad hatter with like a stack of top hats.
I don't know. I feel like you are juggling a lot. So we have some things similar. You studied biochemistry. I studied neurobiology and physiology. And you also studied history. And you thought you were going to go into the medical field or the law field, but then you had a little bit of an epiphany. What happened?
Junior year of college, I got my very first marketing internship. And that was the time something clicked inside of me where I realized storytelling and communicating effectively was not just what I liked to do, but also what I was very good at. In a way, I was not good at chem lab. I enjoyed history, but I didn't want to be a professor or work in a museum, which those career options were pretty limited for an historian. And so I just tripled down on being in Seattle and taking advantage of every sales and marketing internship I could find in the city to really explore and make sure this is what I wanted to end up in. My senior year, I worked for the whole year at a company called ChemPoint. It was a seller and distributor of fine and specialty chemicals to life sciences industry, energy, whatnot. And that to me bridged my science brain. What I learned about analyzing an issue and understanding factors that you may not necessarily assume in history, and this love and talent I had for sales and marketing, and decided like some level of technical sales or scientific sales was probably the next best option for me. I also was burned out of school and I was like, I cannot fathom continuing education more. I just want to make some money. So
totally,
I applied for pharmaceuticals and technical sales jobs and ended up at Cisco Systems right out of college. And that to me was such an incredible experience. Cisco is a phenomenal place to work. And they had this program called the Sales Associates Program. Extremely competitive, a lot of type A people, but you took a year to learn the tech stack, but also learn the mechanics of sales and communications in a way I didn't get in university with these two very different non-business degrees, and spent 2 years in the field supporting the pharma industry And it was at the end of that time that I was feeling drawn to be in industry and not so much supporting it as a vendor. At that time, my father's second company was really starting to grow and scale. And he said, I'm not entirely convinced what you're going to do. You're going to report to my co-founder, but I think it's time if you want to come and join the family business. And growing up, I used to spend Saturdays going to the lab with my dad and enjoying hearing what he had to say. And he did something really special when I was young that I'm trying to also bring in with how I talk about work with the boys, which is he never, ever told me, oh, you're too young to understand. He would take the time to try to explain what he was working on, whether it was a different certain development, product development, or stage of development he was focused on, and explain it to me in a way that I could understand and really simplifying it down for me. So from a young age, I was very, very fascinated by what he did. Going to the lab and watching him work there kind of continued to foster that. So I think in the back of my mind, there was always a part of me that was like, I want to work with my dad one day. I don't know how. And especially when I was like failing chem lab, I was like, it's never going to happen.
You're like, this is a great idea. Well, you know what though? First of all, it's so lovely. I mean, my dad was a dentist and I can't imagine working with my dad. But you know, the other thing about it is a lot of people go the polar opposite way where they're like, oh, my family has this business, but I want no part of it. So it is interesting that you sort of gravitated toward that. But also, I love this dichotomy in your personality because you have this whole one side, which is completely, very specifically pharmaceuticals. And then, I mean, you had a blog, you wrote this travel book. So what took you on the travels in the first place? And what made you become an expert in this area? And what can we learn about how to travel and pack well? Because the airlines lose everyone's luggage now. So do you check luggage?
Never. Almost never. So actually working with my father at Cytos that started in 2009 was the reason I was traveling so much. And then there was this great sense. I have the same blog origin story as every other blogger of that era, which was I had a very uncreative job and I needed a creative outlet. And yep. For me, I needed a creative outlet that I could do on the go, hence Hitha on the go. And so the packing part of things, you know, at the beginning, if you look at those early posts, they are like every other blogger at the time, a couple outfits, which I cringed when I see, but I'm also like, it's a part of the journey. We all have.
Totally. Those. It was right at the time. It was all right at the time.
The bubble necklaces and the arm parties, the embellished mini skirts. It's a hoot to look back on, or like recipes or a little bit of home decor. But it wasn't until I started writing about how I was packing and traveling for business that the blog really started to take off. And of course, this was right when Pinterest hit. So if you had a really like eye-grabbing, simple graphic with like a title that just grabbed your attention, you could go viral very easily on Pinterest. And that's exactly what happened for me. My posts immediately just started getting so much traction and more traffic came to the blog. Opportunities came to the blog for the packing side of things because the only advice that was on the internet at the time was quit your job and sell all your possessions and live out of a backpack. And that's not how people pack and travel. They have a few business trips a year. They have a few vacations a year. And so I started talking to that sensibility, but I had to pack in a carry-on because I was traveling with all old men who could throw a bunch of stuff in the backpack and they would be fine. And here I am in my older 20s, like trying to figure out my own style, trying to figure out how to show up in these rooms that is both in an appropriate manner, but still very true to myself. And that is sort of a knife's edge that was hard to walk on, that I was very open about talking about what I was wearing and how I was packing it and how it made me feel for these, you know, really conservative settings. And so they both kind of happened at the same time. And this was obviously before I had children. So I had the energy to pursue.
Oh, yeah, you have the energy still. I mean, come on, I hear it in your voice. But I think you hit on something that's really important. I mean, when you began your career in the pharmaceutical industry, you were often the only woman in the room, the only person of color in the room, and probably the youngest person in the room. So did that consciously affect your style anyway?
Yes, because I did very much gravitate towards that. I need to be in pantsuits and look a certain way. And while that might have served the dress code of the sense, I realized two things. One, no one cared. And two, I didn't feel good in them. I felt like I was wearing a costume. I did not feel authentically myself. And so I realized a dress to me fit my personality and my style far better than the separates and was far easier to pack. So I started gravitating towards dresses that were tailored well. You know, always invest in a tailor because it will take something that is just okay and make it perfect. Wearing fun shoes because, again, no one cared, but it made me feel a little bit more me, a little bit more connected to myself and my style. And I like my hair pulled back. I find it distracting if it's like in my face. So invest in a lot of pretty claw clips to do a quick chignon and simple makeup. And that made me feel like myself in a way that the suits or the separates or going too casual just never did. And it traveled well. So it felt good to find what made me feel like me in these rooms where I knew I was already going to stand out. So how do I just leverage just to my favor? I'll also say choosing to let my hair go gray was also a part of that calculus as well, because I'm already going to be the youngest person in the room. The gray hair helps me feel a little bit more like I have the gravitas and the experience to show that I belong in that room. Because I've been told before, people think like you're a 22-year-old CEO and they don't trust you because of your age. When I was like 30 and I was like, okay, well, if I'm spending hundreds of dollars to get this covered on a 4-week basis to get this feedback and it's hurting my head and I don't love it anymore, let's try the other direction. So that was also an intention on my hair choice of embracing the gray.
Thank you for sharing that. I think, well, first of all, this whole battle with age, right? Age versus experience versus what people think you should be like at a certain age, at a certain level, it can really play mind games on you.
Yeah, and it did. And I don't think if I had basically my dad in those rooms with me, telling me how he had to overcome it at parts of his career and acted as a sense of protection too, when he was in those meetings with me, because who's going to mess around with the daughter of the inventor of the product you want? Nobody. Also, I had someone to help me navigate those waters, but who also threw me in the deep end plenty of times and made sure I figured out how to swim.
And as far as developing your voice, do you feel like when you started, you were very different than how you are now? And how did you sort of get comfortable being a thought leader in that room, given the situation?
I had incredible mentors and bosses and leaders who took it upon themselves to take the time to teach me the mechanics of the industry that you can't get from Google or you can't get from just reading about technical development, like the how to negotiate, how to read a room, how to move forward. Those are also the people who gave me the opportunities and acknowledged that you will make mistakes and that's okay. The goal here is not perfection. The goal here is progress. And to this day, I learned some of my best lessons and most valuable lessons when a licensing agreement didn't work out and we had to unwind it. I learned more from those experiences than the successful licensing agreements, which I think is really powerful because most people don't get room to make mistakes. Most women of color, it is not a safe space for them to make mistakes. So that expectation of perfection, not just externally, but internally, can weigh on you so deeply. And so to have that is truly a gift and a privilege that I need to acknowledge because it is a big part of my success and in terms of helping me find my voice, because my voice was always celebrated and appreciated. Mm-hmm. It was never used against me.
I love that. But the other side of sort of using your voice, and I'm sure you see this even with people that work with you, is sometimes people don't know sort of how far to push it in a certain situation, right? It's trial and error. So how do you handle giving feedback to people when you're like, okay, I love that you went there, but like, here's what I wish you would have thought of before you did that. Because I think no one likes feedback, but yet really understanding how to take feedback is essential.
Yes. Something I love about how Cisco trains their sales associates and engineers is to actively ask for feedback and to learn how to receive it. So from the very beginning of my career, I always understood as feedback as essential and non-personal. And if it is become personal, how to start to fill that filter to take the personal out of it, not let it affect your heart space and your head space, and to take what is constructive to build better. And so it's something I have considered a lot with feedback to say, let's say focus on the performance and this. So keeping it very clear that we are talking about work here, I like to always make sure I'm crediting and complimenting what they're doing really well and acknowledge that, because I think that's important. And it softens the blow, because no one likes to be the recipient of any kind of negativity. And sometimes our brains will hear it negatively, even if that's not delivered in that way. So I take great care to say, you know, at the last time we connected, these were some of the goals that we had outlined together. So let's take a look at the progress towards those goals. And I try to keep it very objective and positive looking and forward looking. And if there is something constructive to say, it is focused on like the metrics of those goals and not about personality things. That said, I've had to have conversations with them saying, this was extremely unprofessional way of communicating. Don't speak to anyone this way. Don't speak to me this way. Right now in my current company, most of the team members I have known me since I was either a kid or a teenager or the beginning of adulthood. So sometimes it can be very tricky to manage that, because that personal can kind of sometimes trump what is professional and appropriate in those settings. So those have been hard conversations. Those have been emotional conversations where I'm like, I just don't understand why they're behaving this way. And I had to remember, this is someone who viewed me as like Nagesh's little girl. And like, they still in some way are going to view me that way. So how do I change how I react to this? And it is talk less, be firm, establish boundaries, and establish what consequences will happen if those boundaries are crossed. We have, and I think especially as women, this propensity to try to explain and over-communicate. And I've had to learn the opposite, in that restraint and being pithy is actually my power in these really hard situations.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you, because I wanted to understand when you say talk less, what that means. So I totally know what you're saying. And it's almost you're like over accommodating for your thinking, or like what you believe is the best course of action, and really just the direct way of expressing what you think needs to happen next, period, end of report, is more powerful.
Yes. And that's it. What I do to practice that is I do script sometimes what it is I'm going to say, and I will have to put up post-it notes on my computer that says, stop talking.
I love that.
And listen more. And something I have realized that I think will help any person who works in a very conservative, male-dominated industry, and especially with a lot of Europeans, is the Formula One show on Netflix, Drive to Survive, is like, I think, such a brilliant way to understand how to negotiate and how to understand different cultures, like within Europe, especially what their priorities are, how they communicate, how they view deal breakers, how they navigate towards that. Because for me, we have a Belgian partner. Belgians have sometimes very different priorities than like Americans, and they're going to communicate it differently. And you have to learn to listen in a different way that is not the same as how we would communicate in this country or North America or with someone from the UK or someone from France. So that's been an interesting experience for me, because yes, we are co-developing this product and they want to be involved and we also want to keep control. How we work through the issues that come with co-developing anything is learning how to listen and hear what their priorities and feedback are, their preferred forms of communication about these things, and also knowing when to push and when to pull back a bit. So that has been a really unique experience. So that's been something new I've been learning and exploring.
It adds such a layer of complexity, because it's one thing to just learn how to communicate in your own backyard, but in totally another world when you're dealing with literally people in other countries. Let's talk about embracing rejection. I know it's something you've spoken about before. how have you taught yourself to embrace it? And what would you advise people who are starting out now, who are being faced for the first time with rejection?
I mean, I think parenthood is the ultimate rejection training ground, because with like young kids at home, I am told no at least 82 times a morning before like 8 a.m.
That's so true. That's so incredibly true.
And so my capacity for rejection, a yes is like a delightful like surprise to me. It's not something I expect. But for my non-parents and those who choose not to be parents out there, it is something I actually learned a lot from Vice President Harris, who has publicly dealt with rejection, negative press, all of that, to just keep coming back stronger every single time. And there's a quote from her that I remind myself, and I have it like at my desk, which is, eat no for breakfast. When you reframe rejection as something that happens to you into something you consume and devour, it helps take the sting out of it a little bit more. And I also think this goes hand in hand with feedback and learning how to start hearing feedback to filter out the personal sort of nonsense and hear the constructive things that you can grow and build from. I also think there is a sense of not everyone is going to like you, and that's okay, because I certainly don't like everybody or everything. And I just don't take it personally, because one, I'm not going to let what little precious headspace and peace I have be affected by opinions, which are just that, of other people. And if it is a no, I view it as that was never going to be the right fit for us. And that's okay. Let's move on.
What inspired you to take all of Vice President Harris's sort of isms and learnings and put it into a book in the first place?
I am a very, very lucky author in that both of my publishers approached me to write these very specific books with very tight timelines both times. So I want to preface with that Little Brown Spark reached out to me, I think a week after the election had been called, maybe just days, saying, we're looking to do a book about the a lifestyle guide, advice, lessons inspired by the new vice president. Would you be interested in writing this? And I was like, would I? Yes.
Well, wait, hold on. Heather, but why you? Where did they get that idea from?
So I think every publisher probably had a desire to publish a Kamala Harris book on their docket, especially once the election had been called. When I asked my editor, Marissa, why me? She said, well, you know, you have talked about your support of the vice president, not just from, you know, the political and professional lens, but you've talked a lot about what she means to you as a South Asian American woman. I learned a lot about her Indian side after just following you on Instagram and hearing what you have had to say about her. You know, her family is from the same part of India as my husband's family is. Actually, I think her mother is from the same town that my mother-in-law lived in for many, many years of her childhood. So there was this very personal connection, and the media likes to either portray her and put these in these very narrow little boxes, which is just something I wholeheartedly reject. I refuse to be put in a box. I think it's impossible to try to categorize me in a box, and it's uncreative of them to reduce me to one of my identities rather than all my multitudes. That's something I had talked a lot about for myself, as well as how I view the vice president really breaking those boxes and defining herself on her terms. That's what Marissa said. That's why we were drawn to you to do this project, because I've learned a lot about Vice President-elect Harris from just following you. And I think this would make for a great book. And I was like, okay, let's
amazing. Do this. I mean, have you met her? Like, does she know about this book? I'm sure there's many books, but
I have met her at a fundraiser when she was still running for president. She's phenomenal. She's got that uncanny talent of making you feel like you're the most important person in the room and you're the only person she's focused on when she's having a conversation with you. She does know about the book, but it was very clear when I started writing the book that there would be no participation from the family or from the administration, which is a boundary I very much respect. And I think it's a good one to have in place, like in terms of ethics, rules, and whatnot. And it's a boundary that has been consistent for all other books that have been written about her or involving her ascent in politics. So Her memoir was a great source for me in her own words. She's had a long career and a lot of press interviews, but this is also so much a book about the women I know that exhibit these Kamala-isms and have lived them and lead with them in so many powerful ways. So, you know, rather it being I'm speaking, it really is we're speaking, because it's about all of us stepping into our power, rejecting old narratives to build a better, more equitable and just society.
I love, love, love the title. It's so powerful, because I remember when she said quite famously, I'm speaking, you know, we've all had to say that to people. I remember being at a PA meeting before the pandemic, and this dad got up and he went on a rant and rage in the middle of me speaking. And I literally had to say, excuse me, I'm speaking. And like, I said that to like a parent in my school, and not in a nice way, but women often face that. Why do you think we do?
Because we have always been reduced to tropes in a way men have been able to flourish and celebrated for the many things they do. Like, let's take a look at men in power today. No one blinks an eye when Jeff Bezos buys a newspaper, starts a space company after having built one of the biggest companies in the world, this definitively like an oligarchy. Same with Elon Musk. He runs Tesla and SpaceX. It keeps having a ton of children, and nobody questions that. However, I get, well, can you handle it all? You have children. What do you mean you've written books while you run a company? Can you do that? And I'm just like, if you're not asking the same question of Jeff Bezos and Andy Jassy and Elon Musk, you should not be asking this of me as well.
Amen.
And I'm just done with that narrative. I fully reject it, but I'm also here to help shatter it and take like a Thor's hammer to it, because it's reductive, it's unproductive, and it's specifically designed to keep women and underrepresented people small versus giving them the space to step into their power.
So how are you taking all of this amazingness and infusing it into your two sons?
I am very committed at raising feminist sons. And I have told them, you don't understand how lucky you are. One, there is a lot of like mom-splaining on that front of back in my day.
The only we walked miles in the snow.
I mean, for us, the only representation we had was a poo. And now I'm like, you have a class that's 30% South Asian. Like, we have to coordinate the Diwali activities every year, which is a joy for me, because I was like, I never had this. Like, I got asked if we rode magic carpets and everyone had a pet elephant.
I
did have a really good racket on my school bus of reading palms and writing people's names in Telugu that was like highly profitable. And I was like, I am okay with this at 8 years old.
That's hysterical. But
with the boys, you know, I think it's important that my husband and my father model a lot of these values, and it can't just be me talking about them. So, you know, my husband took a career pause. He shifted from being a partner at a consulting firm to joining a venture capital fund as a partner, which gave him a lot more flexibility, especially when I was writing a book and negotiating a deal and then going on book tour and then another speaking tour. I was barely home and he was the one packing backpacks and making lunches and doing drop off and tucking in and all those things that are very much viewed as the mom's activity. And to be asked, well, who's taking care of your kids? I was like, they have a very wonderful father who's fully capable of taking care of them while I am doing this. So being it modeled for them, I think is one of the greatest gifts we can give them. And we have conversations about how do we contribute? One, how do we contribute at home? So the expectation that they will help out with chores and cleaning up their toys and helping mommy unattended or daddy unattended on different things that we're doing around the house. But then there's also this, what are we doing to give back? Because we are ourselves so privileged and lucky and blessed. And it is volunteering. There's this great box company called Altruists that I do with Ro, because one, it's an activity you do together that you then send back to give to people in need, which I think is really powerful. But the booklets that come with every box, you talk about these things. And so I can't wait to bring Rocky, It's a little too young right now, but into those conversations as well. I want to do more volunteering with them. Things have been a little bit crazy, but as work settles down and I focus on home a little bit more, which is where I'm feeling drawn to, that's a big priority for me, is to figure out what does volunteering look like and whether I do it just among us or with the school. I'm excited to explore and find that out. And if you have any resources, anyone does, on good New York volunteering projects with kids, please let me know. And, you know, I think for me, going to India very often as a kid and seeing just how so many different people live, and so many live with a fraction of what I am lucky to have, shaped my worldview from a young age at that point. So it is important for me to be able to take the boys to India and travel with them, so we get that experience of what it's like to, you can't apologize for what you were born into, but if you were born into privilege, I believe you have a responsibility to do what you can to give back, that everyone gets to live with dignity. And that's something we talk a lot about.
That's wonderful. What is a typical day in your life? What time do you wake up and how do you make time for yourself?
So I wake up right now, it's like 6:45, and I grab my phone from across the room and I scroll mindlessly until I hear Rocky chirping in his room, like he's up and ready. Ro gets himself up and dressed, thank goodness. So I don't really have to worry about him. And my husband takes care of getting breakfast ready. So breakfast is out, the kids, he takes care of backpacks. So I focus on getting the kids up and ready. So brushing teeth, getting them dressed. If the kids are wearing something crazy, bringing something that looks a little bit more.
It's so funny.
I'll just say less chaotic. And then with the school year, they're dropped off by 8. That's when I come home and I get in my quick workout and meditation and trying to get like myself sorted and organized. And I'm showered and ready and at my desk usually by 9:15, 9:30. And then every workday is so different. So it could be a lot of calls one day. It could be a more heads down writing day. It could be an admin day where I'm just focused on clearing through my inbox. I forget to eat lunch often, which is really bad. So then by like 3 o'clock, I am hangry and
wait, dying. I cannot relate to this. I cannot relate at all. When it's 12:00 on the dot, I'm like, it's lunchtime.
I had to put it on my calendar to like break for lunch. And then if I don't, sometimes I just choose chaos and ignore it. And then it's 3 o'clock hits and then I'm dying. I have DoorDash Taco Bell more times than I would like to admit. So there's that. Or I just like run to Sweetgreen and pick up a salad. And that can be like my midday walk as well. Try to wrap up by the time the kids are home. We do have an amazing nanny who's been with us since Ro was a baby, who really handles their dinner time and bath time and whatnot. But I do like to try to break and spend that time of when they're eating dinner with them. With Ro, it's doing homework as well, putting the kids down. Some nights I have to get back and get some work done, although that affects my sleep. So I really try to avoid it if I possibly can. But once the kids are down, my husband and I will usually like eat our dinner around that time, watch something. I'll read a book for like a half hour to an hour and try to be lights out by 10:30. Although if the book is really good, I will choose violence and like stay up way too late reading.
Oh my God. I don't remember the last time I went to bed at 10:30. That sounds like a dream. I am up super, super late. So these days, now that you've given birth to 2 books already, what is your next creative outlet? Because I'm sure there's something in you that's like itching to come out.
I have a couple book ideas that I am thinking about. So one is actually a children's book idea that Ro came up with the idea for after reading the Magic Treehouse series. And he was like, Mom, there's something I don't understand in this book. And it's, if these two kids from modern day are walking around ancient Egypt or like King Arthur's time wearing like jeans and t-shirts and talking like us, why would anyone help them? People would be like, what the heck is this? And they would throw them in the dungeon. And I was like, that is accurate. I go, how would you change this? And he's like, what if they were an animal? They could sneak around and nobody would know anything, but they could still see what was happening. I was like, that's
it's very smart.
I was like, tell me more. This is a great idea. So I'd like to actually have like the space to sit down and bang out a manuscript about this, because it also merges science and history. So it's like a perfect convergence.
Oh my God.
Way to channel both of my degrees. I have a couple of other books about women that inspire me, kind of in the same vein of We're Speaking, that I would love to write. People ask if I would ever write a romance novel because, like, I love romance novels. And I actually say no, because I like act like a 12-year-old boy when I read one of the steamy scenes. And I was like, to try to write this is just not my skill set. I think you need to have things in life that are just purely your own enjoyment and that you just consume as a fan. So that is that for me. But I do have some other nonfiction books and more children's fiction projects that I would like to explore. And, you know, I'm feeling like as the kids are getting older, they need you in a different way. So it's not the physical demands of parenting a toddler and young little kids. It is a very different, more mentally challenging time to help like a 7-year-old navigate life as like a kid and getting into that preteen adolescent stage. So to just have a little bit more time at home and space to give them that and give them my energy and mental energy, especially, is a priority to me that I'm excited to kind of take a step back from doing all the things and focus on a fewer things.
I love that. And focus on things that bring you joy also. Sorry, my family upstairs right now is a herd of elephants, literally. I don't know if you hear them walking, but I've never heard anyone louder in my entire life, like literally trying to be loud. So I think it's really interesting. You have all these facets to your life, how you choose to speak about yourself in certain channels. So your bio on Instagram is one way, your multi-hyphenated mom on LinkedIn, your CEO of a pharmaceutical company and speaker. How do you decide what to put where?
I think it depends on what content I'm sharing where. So LinkedIn to me is so professional that it is, here are all the awesome things I am doing at work. Instagram is that showing all the sides of my life. So I am a little bit more forthcoming about how motherhood is and leading into it a little bit more, but also trying to figure out, just like anyone, the right way of showing my kids on the internet in such a crazy and rapidly changing time. Twitter, I'm pretty unhinged on Twitter, and it's mostly like political or like random moments of joy that I find on that platform. So that reflects more of that. I feel like I'm a pretty active member of the K-Hive and defending the vice president against trolls. So that's a part of that. I don't know the last time I logged in on Facebook, and I have no idea what I'm doing on TikTok. So it's kind of all over the place.
All fair points. So is being a multi-hyphenate sort of the new goal? Do you think if you were advising younger women, would you tell them to be a multi-hyphenate or would you tell them to focus?
I actually think they are, in a way that they just own the word in their daily actions and what they choose to do. Earlier this year, I did an amazing project with Yum Brands, where I was the MC and moderator of a series of culture summits that Taco Bell hosted for their executives and franchisees that owned many restaurants. And it was specifically the panelists who participated were members of Gen Z, who had all these jobs and all these roles and all these passions and interests that I was like, I might be the OG, but like you all are taking and claiming this title with such pride and strength and owning it so powerfully. So that is the norm. If I can help give advice on how to manage your time, how to manage your energy, you know, being the mom and saying, are you taking care of yourself? Are you drinking enough water? Are you taking your vitamins? Are you eating something green? Are you sleeping? I'm happy to do that, but it's something they're already doing on their own. And so, however, I could just be helpful, and I approach it with a lot of humility because Gen Z is growing up in a very different world than we did. Not to say we as millennials didn't have our own challenges, but to see kind of the state of the world today versus when I was still, you know, in my earlier 20s, it's very different. And it is a lot noisier. There is more demands on what you're able to do. Cost of living is higher. Student education is so much higher than it was for me. I paid $4,000 a year in annual tuition, which I was like, oh my God, like I can't even imagine that today. So I actually approach talking to Gen Z with a great deal of humility because I will never know what it's like to be in their shoes and to deal with the things they have had to deal with. Insofar, my advice can be helpful. I am here for that, but I'm also here to learn from them just as much.
all good points. And it's so funny. I just realized when you said that, that like you and I are not in the same generation, which makes me feel really old. So, okay. You have all this amazingness happen. You have so many more things you're going to do. When you think about how you ultimately want to leave your mark, what do you want to be known for? If you do have to pick one thing, what is the most important thing?
I would like to be known for helping people, especially women, save time and energy on all the stuff they have to do, whether that is optimizing your time, wholeheartedly rejecting things that society has told you you need to do, but you really don't, or learning how to delegate and offload some things to save time and energy for that they actually want to do, and to help them step in and claim the titles they want to claim, the roles they want, and the mark they want to leave on the world to help enable that some more. So I just see myself as hopefully a catalyst for change, for helping people leave their mark as well, but helping take some things off their plate.
Beautifully said. I love it. Well, you've certainly already done so much of that, and you'll continue to do it. Heather, it's so awesome spending time with you, and just keep doing what you're doing. And I love seeing you on Instagram. Your energy is amazing. You're joyful. And I think, you know, you're going to continue to do great things.
Thank you so much. This has been such a joy and honor for me. And thank you so much for modeling and leading the way of how you can enjoy social media and still use it as a professional tool in your power. So you really led the way for so many people, like me included. So thank you.
Oh, thank you. So sweet. Thanks so much for listening to Leave Your Mark, the podcast. If you want more career advice, be sure to pick up a copy of my best-selling book, Leave Your Mark. If you're on Instagram, make sure to follow at Leave Your Mark Podcast to stay up with the latest episodes. And of course, say hi to me at Aliza Licht XO. If you're on Twitter, definitely reach out at Aliza Licht. I would love to hear from you. If you want to subscribe to my newsletter or attend a future virtual mentoring event, go to alizalicht.com for more information. And just remember this, if change doesn't hurt a little, it's not change. Keep on rocking.